In today's podcast, I want to talk about the subject of propaganda. Now, I was watching a movie the other day on Netflix, and I'll come to Netflix a little bit later on in this podcast, but I was watching a movie on Netflix called Arrival. I think it's called Arrival or Arrivals. Some of you may have seen it. It's a sci-fi movie in which aliens invade planet Earth, and the various governments in all the different countries are scrambling around trying to figure out why the aliens are here, what do they want, are they hostile or are they friendly? And as usual, the Americans are portrayed as the heroes. And also, as usual, Russia, China, Iran, Pakistan are portrayed as trigger-happy, gung-ho, and the most likely to shoot first and ask questions later. Now, to me, this is a classic case of subliminal programming and a classic case of propaganda. Now, whether or not the director of this movie intended it to be propaganda, I don't know. Perhaps he's just he or she is just a brainwashed individual who's going along with the program because that's how they were programmed. Or then again, maybe there is some deep state or government involvement in the writing of some of these scripts for these movies. I don't know. But what I do know is, whether it was intentional by the director or not, it had the same effect. And the effect was to subliminally convince people. Because in this movie, the propaganda is not in your face. At least not, you know, to most people. It's fairly subtle. But that's why it's all the more dangerous, because a lot of people, particularly in Europe, are not as susceptible to overt propaganda as they are in the United States. So for people in Europe, if you are going to try and push propaganda upon them, you have to be a little more sophisticated than the way you would be in the United States, okay? And, you know, most European people will recognize this. Now, as I say, in this movie, it's fairly subtle, but it's there. And the reason that I call this propaganda is because it's the exact opposite of reality. The reality is the United States is by far and away the most trigger-happy nation on planet Earth today. The United States is the epitome of shoot first, ask questions later. And when the United States normally get around to asking questions, hundreds of thousands, sometimes even millions of people, mainly civilians, are dead. This happens time after time after time after time in all these armed conflicts and wars that the United States starts more often than not. So to be putting this kind of idea in people's subconscious in a movie like this, that it's Russia and it's China and it's Iran, Pakistan, these are the countries who are so trigger happy that are going to mess things up for everyone and cause the end of the world by upsetting these aliens. These are the ones you need to worry about. The United States are going to be exercising the most restraint. It's the exact opposite of what reality is. That's propaganda. Now, again, I don't know whether it was the intention of the director to put this subliminal message across. But one thing I would certainly argue is that if he was trying to put the opposite message across, for example, that it's the United States who are the most gung-ho, who are going to mess up things for everybody, and it's China, Russia, Iran, etc., which are exercising more restraint. If you were trying to put a movie out that was coming from that angle, I seriously doubt you would find it so easy to get funding for the movie. I seriously doubt you'd find it so easy to get backing for your movie if you were coming from that angle. And that shows you how closely linked government is to the upper echelons of the socioeconomic hierarchy. And You need to bear this in mind, people. The political hierarchy and the socioeconomic hierarchy are two different hierarchies. Just because you're at the top of the political hierarchy, it does not mean you're at the top of the socioeconomic hierarchy. The socioeconomic hierarchy is full of people who own stuff, full of people whose wealth doesn't go away, full of people whose power and influence doesn't go away during the end of an election cycle. This is why I always place far more emphasis on researching people at the top of the socioeconomic hierarchy than people at the top of the political hierarchy. Because people at the top of the political hierarchy, they are here today, gone tomorrow politicians. How much power do they really have when, if they get voted out, who are they again? They're a nobody again. Yeah, they might have some little corporate job here and there, but in the grand scheme of things, they are not the ones who have the most assets generally. They're not the ones who have their hands in the financial system to the largest degree. They're not the ones who own the most mines and mercenary companies and all that kind of business. Natural resources. No, generally, the politicians are not those people. So I'm more interested in looking at who those people are. And they are generally people at the top of the socioeconomic hierarchy. And the people at the top of the socioeconomic hierarchy are the ones who are going to fund, like in the United States, they're going to fund movies. And it just so happens that in the vast majority of these movies, what are they portraying? If there is any kind of portrayal of geopolitics, they're portraying America as the good guys. Not always completely good. Sometimes they'll be portrayed as kind of benevolent rogues, you know, who do some dirty deeds here and there for the greater good. Sometimes they'll portray themselves as that, but ultimately, the likes of Russia, China, Iran, etc. will be portrayed as less intelligent, unscrupulous, more trigger happy, the exact opposite of what the reality is. Now, I'm not for a second trying to say that those countries I've just mentioned don't disseminate propaganda as well. They most certainly do. And I'm also not trying to say that those countries are benevolent. They're most certainly not. The world is run by criminals. The world is run by gangsters, just high-level gangsters. Gangsters in Iran, gangsters in Pakistan, gangsters in the United States, so on and so forth. The world's run by gangsters. That's how it goes, all right? But the reason I bring this up is to enlighten people to the fact that they are being exposed to propaganda on a constant basis, sometimes more subliminally than other times. And I think this particular movie, Arrival, is an example of this subtle and subliminal propaganda that can be disseminated in movies a lot of the time. Okay, and again, it could be in this movie just secondary propaganda, a situation where, you know, sometimes I firmly believe that governments, intelligence agencies, or people, you see, in Hollywood, there are going to be a certain amount of people who are working for intelligence agencies. All right, just like I've spoken about in the past, Jon Snow, the very well-known Channel 4 news presenter, publicly said that he was once offered money by MI5 to work for them, you know, essentially. Work for them covertly while continuing his career as a TV presenter. He would be covertly working as an MI5 agent. He admitted this publicly. Now, he was offered double his salary, tax-free, totally untraceable, if he agreed to work for them. He claims he turned them down. How many people within the media haven't turned those kind of offers down? Now, this was Jon Snow. I think he said it took place in the 70s when MI5 approached him. Are we to believe that this kind of thing isn't going on now? I think people would be deeply naive if they didn't think it's still going on today. And in Hollywood, it's most important to control the narrative because this shapes human perception. The media shapes the way you perceive the world. And the way you perceive the world is how you're going to interact with the world. What you perceive is what you believe, and what you believe is what you're going to act upon. It's going to influence your behavior. And if you think that government and intelligence agencies are not interested in the behavior of human beings, I don't know how stupid you must be to think that. Of course, they're deeply interested. Now, there are many, many instances of, for example, the American military collaborating with Hollywood. Okay? But what I'm saying is, covertly, there has to be people within Hollywood and other movie industries around the world in different countries. There have to be people within there who are agents of intelligence or agents of the deep state, so on and so forth. And their job is to steer the narrative of those movie industries to make sure that certain messages are allowed to be pushed and other messages are suppressed, like the messages I've described in the movie Arrival. Now, let me talk about somebody who is very important when it comes to the subject of propaganda. Those of you who have never studied this subject before, you need to look this guy's name up, and I'll leave a link in the description below to the article where I'm getting a lot of this information. The man was called Edward Bernays. And again, this is a man who comes from the upper echelons of the social and economic hierarchy. And you'll see how incestuous the socioeconomic hierarchy is with politics when I read some of the facts about this man and his life. So here we go. Edward Bernays was born to a Jewish family, the son of Eli Bernays and Anna Freud Bernays. Bernays was a double nephew of psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud by virtue of his mother, who was Freud's sister, and of his father's sister, Martha Bernays Freud, who married Sigmund. Bernays was an Austrian-American pioneer in the field of public relations and propaganda, referred to in his obituary as the father of public relations, and more colloquially, he's known as the father of propaganda. He was the subject of a full-length biography by Larry Tye called The Father of Spin in 1999, and later an award-winning 2002 documentary for the BBC by Adam Curtis called The Century of Self. More recently, Bernays is noted as the great uncle of Netflix co-founder Mark Randolph. His best-known campaigns include a 1929 effort to promote female smoking by branding cigarettes as feminist, quote-unquote, torches of freedom, and his work for the United Fruit Company connected with the CIA-orchestrated overthrow of the democratically elected Guatemalan government, in 1954. He worked for dozens of major American corporations, including Procter & Gamble and General Electric, and for government agencies, politicians, and non-profit organizations. Of his many books, Crystallizing Public Opinion, published in 1923, and Propaganda, published in 1928, gained special attention as early efforts to define and theorize the field of public relations. He described the masses as irrational and subject to herd instinct, and outlined how skilled practitioners could use crowd psychology and psychoanalysis to control them in desirable ways. Another one of his notable works, which he doesn't mention in this little intro here, was a book called, an essay, not a book, called The Engineering of Consent, And that was published in, sorry, it was a book in the end, it says here, but it was initially an essay published in 1947. The book was published in 1955. Think about the name of that book, The Engineering of Consent. I'll come back to that a little later on. But let me just talk about some of the things that this individual was involved in. It says here, Benes advised William O. Dwyer in his candidacy for mayor of New York City on how to appear in front of different demographics. For example, he should tell Irish voters about his actions against the Italian mafia and Italian voters about his plans to reform the police department. To Jews, he should appear as a committed opponent of the Nazis. In the 1930s, his Dixie Cup campaign was designed to convince consumers that only disposable cups were sanitary by linking the imagery of an overflowing cup with subliminal images of vaginas and venereal disease. Benes used his uncle Sigmund Freud's ideas to help convince the public, among other things, that bacon and eggs was the true all-American breakfast. Now, I could go on with examples of the things that Benes was involved in by way of propaganda. And this is not just political propaganda. This is obviously propaganda and subliminal programming, subliminal messages for various different companies and corporations who are hoping to sell things to the public. But just to go over some of the things that I already mentioned, the one about smoking. He was involved in a campaign to popularize smoking among women. He was ostensibly the brainchild behind the campaign in terms of selling the cigarette as a feminist torch of liberation. Propaganda, not always, but very often, is about deceiving and lying to the public. And here we have a man in Edward Bernays who was almost like a Svengali figure in the world of propaganda. I mean, he was everywhere, this man. He was working for all kind of different corporations and companies, all kind of different governments around the world, not just the American government, but several governments around the world. I mean, this guy was, you know, they called him the father of spin, the father of propaganda. Anybody who has any kind of ethics or morals would understand that what this guy was doing was beyond the pale. This guy was out to deceive on an unbelievable scale and out to convince other people, well, not convince other people, excuse me, out to teach other people the best ways to deceive. Like, for example, when he was advising the individual whose name escapes me, if I can find him a second, O'Dwyer was his surname, on how best to run for office of mayor of New York City, he was basically trying to teach him how to tell the public what they want to hear. Regardless of whether you actually believe in what you're saying or not, that's irrelevant. Benes was coaching this man on what to say to which demographic in order to win their confidence, win their support, and ultimately win their votes. You see, this is what politics is all about. For the most part, from what I've seen in my lifetime, politics is about telling people what they want to hear. It's not about what a politician truly believes in his or her heart. It's not about what the truth actually is. No, when you're running for election, particularly, you're telling the voters what they want to hear. You're selling them a dream. And you know you're selling them a dream. You know you can't deliver. You know you won't deliver. But you want to get in public office. You want to get that check. You want to get, in this day and age, that second home. and have all your expenses paid for and have the cushy job, the cushy lifestyle, and on top of the nice gig that you get being a politician, particularly if you're in cabinet or shadow cabinet, on top of that cushy gig, in this day and age, you very often got a corporate job too. Simultaneously, or sometimes once you leave office, then you go into a corporate job, you come out of your corporate job, go back into political office again. The revolving door, they call it. I mean, if that is not a conflict of interest, I don't know what is. So Edward Bernays is definitely somebody you should look up. And here's what I'm saying. I'm saying that Edward Bernays is not the last of a dying breed. Edward Bernays was the first, or one of the first, of a new breed. I'm saying that Edward Bernays and people of his ilk, right? So, well, Edward Bernays is now dead. He died in 1995, aged 103, I might add, okay? This is somebody from the upper echelons of society who his uncle was Sigmund Freud, and now one of his descendants is Mark Randolph, the co-founder of Netflix. I mean, is this a coincidence here, people? Given that kind of link, is it unreasonable to suggest that Netflix could be involved in disseminating propaganda, since the co-founder of Netflix has got somebody like this in his family? You know, we, particularly when you come from a powerful family like Bernays, they pass their ideas on down through the generations, because these are not people like the average person, no disrespect, living on a council estate, who's just living hand to mouth, trying to raise their kids and put food in their mouths and clothes on their back. They're not really thinking about the bigger concepts. They can't. They don't have time to. But when you come from a moneyed family like Bernays, these people, the way they raise their kids is very different, because they're not struggling and they do have time to think about larger concepts and pass these things on down to their children. That's why they have this generational wealth, because they're not raising children who are stupid and they're going to squander all their money. I'm sure that happens occasionally, but for the most part, they're raising children who are going to be involved in co-founding Netflix, for example. All right, it's not a direct child of Bernays, but it's someone within his family line. So, you know, Bernays, the stuff that he was involved in, it's pretty incredible that one man could be involved in all this kind of stuff. But I am sure that there are people today in the background who are involved in the things that Bernays was involved in to just as great a degree, maybe more so. People we're not aware of. Because the way that Bernays is dealt with by the mainstream media in Britain and the West today is that, oh, well, people like him used to exist back in the days. These Svengali figures in media and what, yeah, they used to exist back in the days, but today we've moved on and, you know, we don't engage in that kind of thing anymore. Maybe in Russia and China and Iran, they might have Edward Bernays type figures out there, but in the West, oh, no, we don't have anybody like that. We wouldn't have any need for them. We follow the truth all the time. We don't lie. We've got no reason to have propaganda. Subliminally, this is what we're told, and this is the general approach that the media takes in the Western world when it comes to people like Bernays. But as I say, when you look at all the stuff he was involved in, the tactics that he was using, and yeah, I wanted to come back to the title of his book, initially an essay, and then it was a book in 1955 called The Engineering of Consent. What does that mean? Now, consent is when you agree to something happening. So to engineer consent implies that you are trying to get somebody's consent through deceptive means. You're trying to trick somebody into agreeing. You're trying to trick somebody into consenting. That is very, very often used when it comes to any kind of legal situation, is engineering consent. In politics is often used. Tricking you into agreeing, sometimes making you believe that you have to agree by subtly threatening you or implying that there's some kind of bad consequences for you if you don't agree. That's a example of engineering consent. Or sometimes it's a situation like with weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was a provable lie. But all the government needed to do is put out enough propaganda to frighten the people in the Western world, in Britain and America, into consenting to this war. And when enough people consented, obviously in Parliament and stuff like that, as well as the general public, then we invaded Iraq. And hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of civilians lost their lives. When it comes to figures that come out of these war zones, your guess is as good as mine or anybody else's. Anybody who claims to have a definitive number of the amount of civilians which died in Iraq, they're just talking out of their ass. War is chaotic. Things are covered up, buried, blamed on the other side, so on and so forth. That's the nature of war. Now, speaking of war and propaganda, I want to play you a clip from a very interesting interview, which you guys can find on YouTube, with a veteran of the Vietnam War, an American soldier. And this interview is so interesting because it shows you the disconnect between what the public are told in the United States about any given war and what's actually going on the ground. And I did a podcast several months ago about the military. It was called Stop Joining the Military. All right, any of you can look it up here on Patreon. And in that podcast, I was mainly dealing with the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and how there are all kinds of atrocities being committed by American and British troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, which are swept under the rug. Now, particularly with the American troops, they were mowing down civilians on a regular basis. And to get away with it, and it was so commonplace, them mowing down civilians, and this is going back to what I said earlier in the podcast about shoot first, ask questions later. It was so common for them to do this, to just mow down civilians, that they would go out on reconnaissance after mowing down civilians with truckfuls of AK-47s. And when they would pull up to a dead body of somebody they've mowed down, a woman, a child, or a man, they would look at them to see if they had any weapons. And very often these were civilians. When they realized it's a civilian, they would throw out a shovel next to the body or an AK-47 to make it look as though these people were not civilians, they were actually combatants. A shovel because they were digging up the road, you know, to make it look like they were digging up the road to plant an IED, which is an improvised explosive device. Or an AK-47 to make it look like, you know, they're an armed insurgent. So the podcast I did was covering all that, the kind of deception that goes on and the disconnect between what we're told through the media in the West is going on the ground and what's actually going on. And it doesn't just stop there in terms of the actions of the military, of our military. It doesn't just stop there. The misinformation is also in regards to the nature of the enemy and who the enemy is. And also the nature of the allies and who the allies are. Because at any point in time, we are usually led to believe that whoever we're supporting in whatever armed conflict, they are the good guys. They are the moderates, quote unquote. That's the term they like to use a lot now in the Western media, the moderate rebels. They're the ones we're supporting. Historically, this is proven to be an absolute lie. The Mujahideen in Afghanistan were being funded by the West. The Mujahideen are known and acknowledged now to be extreme, the most extreme of extreme Islamists. And these were the people who were being funded, enabled, armed, etc. by the West to fight the Russians in Afghanistan during the Cold War. And among those Mujahideen was, I'm sure you guys already know, Osama bin Laden. Now, years after the fact, the governments of the West are saying, oh, well, we made a mistake. We didn't, you know, blah, blah. No, there are no mistakes. They knew how radical the Mujahideen were. But it was a means to an end. So at the time, they portrayed the Mujahideen as freedom fighters. Now today, you get it with the Kurds. Oh, the Kurds, you know, we need to help them. And the moderates in the Middle East, we need to help these people and blah, blah, blah. I've known Turkish people, many Turkish people throughout my life. And there's two sides to every story. For every story about Kurds being oppressed or being attacked, subjugated by Turks, you have many other stories from Turks about Kurds committing atrocities against Turks and against Arabs. There are two sides to every story, but of course, as long as the West is supporting the Kurds, they're the good guys. They don't commit atrocities. The reality is, in a place like Iraq, Syria, these countries which are now decimated through war, there are going to be atrocities committed by all sides. There are going to be ruthless killers, psychopaths, torturers on all sides. The idea that this side is good and that side is bad. No, everybody's coming there to do bad. And I remember watching this documentary about the British military. And the British military were in Afghanistan and they'd lost a few men. And a few of their men had been captured and tortured to death and then skinned and stuff like that and hung up in trees, their body parts cut to pieces. And the leader of this particular regiment was saying how when he saw his men, or not necessarily his men, but, you know, British or American soldiers who had been tortured to death and cut to pieces and all that kind of business, it made him want to go and do it to them. And that's what you get in war. You get this, you know, one-upmanship where everybody becomes progressively more vicious. War is a terrible thing, which is why we should try and avoid it at all costs. Only in the most extreme circumstances in self-defense, or sometimes a preemptive strike if you really, really fear that a country is about to attack you and there's solid evidence for it and they've got such a military that could attack you. Not weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, because that was all BS. We know that now. We knew that then, really. Many people knew it then. But when you're talking about the lives of hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians or even millions, you need to be very careful about going to war. It is a dirty and ugly business. There's nothing glorious about it. There's nothing nice about it. It's disgusting. And when you follow the pattern of the United States, particularly over the last several decades, look how many wars they've engaged in. How many times have countries invaded the United States? I'm waiting. You tell me, how many times have countries invaded the United States? And compare that to how many times the United States has invaded other countries. And then tell me who the real threat is. How many people, how many civilians is the United States responsible for killing in armed conflicts over the past several decades? I mean, it's staring you right there in the face, people. But anyway, I'm going to play this clip. And this is to do with the Vietnam. This shows you how history repeats itself. That we haven't learned from the past. This clip, as I say, is an interview with a Vietnam War veteran. And he's detailing the kind of things he got up to in Vietnam. The kind of reception he got from the Vietnamese people. And the realization, eventually, that what he was being told in the media in the United States and what the general public was being told about the war was a crock of lies. And what was actually going on the ground was very, very different. And this soldier, or this former soldier, this veteran, comes to the realization that not only did the Vietnamese hate him, but they had every right to hate him. They should hate him. He details how the Viet Cong, right? It was in the United States, the conflict was sold to the public as the Viet Cong, who are the communists. It's them oppressing everybody else in Vietnam and trying to impose their communist will upon the country. Whereas what this veteran found is the Viet Cong had far more support than he realized. And one of the most poignant things that he says in the interview is that we, as in the American military, were actually creating the Viet Cong. Us being there and us terrorizing this nation of people and committing untold atrocities on them was actually growing the Viet Cong. It was making people who were not, you know, Vietnamese who were not Viet Cong previously, rally behind the Viet Cong because of all the atrocities we were committing, the American military. And so what the hell do you think happens in the Middle East today? What has been happening since the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan? How many years ago was it now? It's well over a decade now. What do you think's been happening? Anti-Western sentiment in the Middle East hasn't gone down during that period. It's risen exponentially. And I heard somebody talking about this the other day in a YouTube video. And I can definitely confirm this to be true. Is prior to 9/11, prior to the West invading Iraq and Afghanistan, certainly in the 80s and 70s, and look, I wasn't in the Middle East them times, but people who were will tell you that Arabs, Muslims in the Middle East had a reverence for not just Western culture, but American culture. And remember, in, I guess, the 50s, 60s, 70s, this is before Wahhabism was really popular in places like Saudi Arabia. Wahhabism has been around for about 200 something years, but it's only become very popular in the Middle East over the past few decades. Prior to that, people who, you know, from the West who have been to the Middle East and traveled around there will tell you that Wahhabism, you know, wasn't anywhere near as popular back then. So the Middle East was very different. And the Middle East back then, even somewhere like Saudi Arabia, was far more hospitable to Westerners. And many Arabs, many Muslims in that region had a reverence for the United States and they thought America was great. They thought it was this great land where there were amazing things and so on and so forth. And so many American things and Western things were popular in the Middle East. But the West's support for the actions of the Israeli government have soured the Arabs towards the West somewhat. But after 9/11, after the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, that's when the souring of, you know, the public sentiment towards the West in the Middle East hit an all-time high. And it's been going up and up and up and up since. Violence begets violence. I mean, that should be common sense to everybody, right? And that's going back to what I was talking about earlier in the podcast about Shoot first, ask questions last. Shoot first and worry about consequences later. And it's my contention that when America and these various militaristic governments are shooting first, they know what the consequences are going to be before they do it. Which shows you that their end goal is not what they tell you their end goal is. Anyway, let me play the clip and I'll speak about it afterwards.
Well, when I got to Vietnam, I literally expected to be welcomed with open arms by the people of Vietnam. I had in my head the black and white newsreels I had seen on the Walter Cronkite 20th Century show of the American troops rolling through villages in France and being showered with wine and flowers and kisses. And as we were driving down, a guy from the battalion I was assigned to picked me up in a Jeep at Da Nang, and we had to drive the 20 miles to where my battalion was located. And I really was disappointed that there weren't people standing along the road waving to me and, you know, offering me flowers and things. I really expected to be greeted as with open arms as a liberator, and it was as though I was invisible. It was as though I didn't exist. And that was a little perplexing. On the third day I was there, this guy who had picked me up in the Jeep, a corporal who I was ultimately going to replace, he and I were in the battalion intelligence section. We were sent down to the tractor park, the amphibious tractor park, to meet a bunch of detainees. It was our responsibility to take care of prisoners, and detainees were a classification of civilians. They were not combatants. They could be detained for questioning, which is why they were called detainees. And Jimmy and I went down there to the track park, and two tractors came in. They had a whole bunch of Vietnamese up on top, the high, flat-topped vehicles, about 8 or 9 feet tall. And as the tracks wheeled into the park, the Marines up on top immediately began hurling these people off. They were bound hand and foot, so that they had no way of breaking their falls. And they were old men, women, children, no young men. And I couldn't believe these guys were treating these people this way. And I turned to Jimmy and said, I grabbed him by the arm and said, what are those guys doing? We're supposed to be helping these people. And Jimmy turned to me and he looked at my hands on his arm, I sort of took them off, and he said, Earhart, you better keep your mouth shut until you know what's going on around here. And I think it was at that point that I realized things were not quite what I was expecting. It went downhill from there. And then you go through villages and, you know, you get sniped at, and so you call an airstrike in on the village and the whole village goes up. Or you go through a place and you search it and you burn houses and blow them up. You know, the common perception, the notion I had when I was in high school was that it was the Viet Cong terrorized the Vietnamese population, forced them to fight against the Americans on at pain of death. What I began to understand in Vietnam was that they didn't need to do things like that. All they had to do was let a Marine patrol go through a village. And whatever was left of that village, they had all the recruits that they needed. I began to understand why the Vietnamese didn't greet me with open arms, why they in fact hated me. But of course that didn't change the fact that my friends were getting killed and injured every day, and the only place that you could focus your own anger and fear was on those civilians who were there. And so it was this self-perpetuating mechanism. The longer that we stayed in Vietnam, the more Viet Cong there were, because we created them, we produced them. What I began to understand within days, and which became patently clear within months, was that what was going on here was not what I'd been told. What was going on here was nuts, and I wanted to get out. I could not have made sense of what I was seeing and doing in Vietnam because I did not have a full deck of cards. I needed to have an understanding of the political and historical realities that brought us to Vietnam before I could make sense of what I was seeing. I began to acquire the other cards in the deck during the 3 years or so after I got back from Vietnam. But while I was there, nothing made sense because I kept trying to, you know, play this game with 27 cards instead of 52 cards, and it kept not coming out right. And I didn't know why. All I knew was that it was nuts. I mean, it became clear within 3 or 4 months that my reasons for being in Vietnam were not clear. I mean, this notion of defending the people against these invaders from North Vietnam, the people hated me. The Vietnamese people hated me. And it was perfectly, that was perfectly clear. I mean, people didn't say good morning to you. People didn't, people hated me. The Vietnamese people hated me, and I gave them every reason to hate me. I beat them. I sometimes killed them. I destroyed their houses. I destroyed their crops. I destroyed their fields. I destroyed their culture. Why in the hell should those people like me? And I could see that I was doing that. And I could see that nothing we were doing was having any impact on the war itself. You know, the funny thing about Vietnam is that I was getting Time magazine every week. It came in the mail. I could read about my war even as I sat in the middle of it. And I would read about what Lyndon Johnson would say and what McNamara would say and what Rusk would say. And I could look around and see that I don't know what war they're talking about, but that's not what's going on here.
So there you go. That's the clip of the American Vietnam veteran detailing his experiences in Vietnam and the realization that he was being fed a crock of lies by his military, by the government. He saw his own people committing untold atrocities against the Vietnamese people, and he could fully understand why the Vietnamese hated him and were trying to kill him. And it wasn't a case of it being a black and white war where it was the Viet Cong versus, you know, the other Vietnamese, the resistance or whatever the case. It wasn't like that. It was like everybody, the whole country was Viet Cong, basically, virtually, because the American military's presence was making the Viet Cong far more popular than it was beforehand. So he was basically explaining the futility of the whole situation. And as I say, this is a great example of propaganda. When he talked about reading the magazine, the stuff they were saying in there, the propaganda that you're fed about these wars. You see, there are so many people who think they're experts on the conflicts that are going around in the world today because they digest Western media, newspapers, Western documentaries, so on and so forth. And, oh, I'm an expert. I know exactly what's going on over there. I've been studying it. Yeah, based upon Western media, which is coming from a certain perspective. You need to look at the other side. You need to look at the media from the Middle East. You need to look at the media from Russia. You need to look at the media from China. You need to look at stuff that's not in the media. You need to look at independent journalists who's actually been to these war zones. Independent. Not working for the independent newspaper. I'm talking about freelance people. People who give you an alternative view on what's going on over there. You need to hear from all sides. Particularly, you need to concentrate on hearing from people who are not funded or backed by major news organizations or governments. You need to hear from as many of those people as possible. Because the fact that they're not funded by major companies means that they are far fewer, there are far fewer of them. That's why you need to hear from so many of them. Seek them out and listen to what they're saying, which contradicts what you're told in the mainstream Western press. Very important that you do that if you hope to even get close to what the actual truth is. And none of us can ever know the absolute truth but we can try and get as close as possible. So anyway, I'm going to end the podcast right here, people. Hopefully you found it interesting. Just be aware of propaganda in movies, television, video games, newspapers, even among friends and family when you're having conversations. Just be cognizant of the subliminal messages which are being conveyed and communicated, sometimes unintentionally. If one person has been programmed, they're going to subliminally program a next person. You know, unintentionally, sorry. Program a next person. The world is run by criminals. This whole idea of good versus bad in geopolitics, I mean, it's all relative. But who's doing the most killing now and historically? Who's the most gung-ho now and historically? Who's got the highest body count now and historically? Those are the people who you need to be most wary of when it comes to their actions and also the propaganda they're putting out. As I say, through their media, the methods they're going to use. And it really is very important, and I don't know how else to describe it, but it's very important to research individuals like Edward Bernays. Don't think of Edward Bernays as a man, you know, who lived to 103 and died in March 1995, and so his era and his methods are over. No. Look at Edward Bernays as a case study of what really goes on behind the scenes when it comes to media, when it comes to political campaigns. Look at him as a case study for that. This is what, these are the kind of people, the brains, the minds behind the BBC, CNN, Fox News, the newspapers, Netflix, every aspect of media, politics. People like Bernays today are the brains behind all that. And let me go to one of the things that Bernays said here. All right, now, imagine, right? I keep thinking about the torches of freedom, you know, cigarettes being promoted by Bernays as feminist torches of freedom. Incredible, isn't it? Because they just wanted to sell cigarettes. So they preyed upon the gullible masses. It says here, yeah, Bernays described the masses as irrational and subject to herd instinct, and outlined how skilled practitioners could use crowd psychology and psychoanalysis to control them in desirable ways. This is how the world is run. This is what Bernays and his ilk and the powers that be today, the social engineers, Edward Bernays is actually the epitome of a social engineer. That's what he is. You see, some people will depict Bernays as a hitman for hire. And to some extent he was. But don't be mistaken into thinking that Bernays didn't have his own ideology. Don't be mistaken into thinking that. Him being a hitman for hire was part of his ideology. And I say hitman in terms of a propaganda hitman. But the fact that he said the masses, that means us, me and you, we are irrational and subject to herd instinct. Skilled practitioners like him use crowd psychology and psychoanalysis to control them in desirable ways. And you see that everywhere. you really have to detach from the masses to see what the masses are doing. And definitely the older, I've always been someone that's somewhat detached from the masses. And the older I get, the more detached I become. And the more detached you become from the masses, the more you can see the way they're being manipulated. The more you can see the crowd, the hive mind, the herd instinct that Benes was talking about. The more you can see it. Benes, the unscrupulous character that he was, had no issue manipulating and controlling the masses in ways which were detrimental to the masses. He had no issue doing that. But other people who actually do have morals and ethics would hope to try and manipulate the masses in a more positive way. Or perhaps even to enlighten the masses. And I'm a little conflicted about whether it's even possible or not to enlighten the masses. The older I get, the more I suspect that it's actually not possible to enlighten them. But I do think it is, and this is something I talk about on a regular basis, that most human beings, this is where I agree with Benes to some extent, most human beings are sheep-like. They cannot think outside of the herd mentality. And within the herd, within the masses, are doctors, people with PhDs, scientists. Don't for a second think that these people are outside of the herd mentality, because the vast majority of them, educated people, are very much within the herd mentality. It's a small minority of people who can think outside, who can detach themselves from the herd psychologically and emotionally and look at the situation from a bird's eye perspective. Very small percentage of people who can do that. Most people, to some extent, are part of that. And even within the so-called truth movement or the conspiracy movement, it's a herd mentality where people jump on this week's latest conspiracy and everybody believes it, regardless of how outlandish the conspiracy is, how unfounded it is, how shaky the evidence is. They're all jumping on it in a herd mentality kind of way, believing it wholeheartedly. They're behaving in the exact same way as the mainstream herd, who believe everything that the government says and everything that the mainstream media pushes out, or most things that the mainstream media push out. People in the alternative, in the conspiracy research, truth movement, etc., most of them behave in the same way. They just believe something different. They believe a whole heap of other different propaganda or different lies, but they still behave in that same way with the herd mentality. Now, obviously, there are loads of conspiracies that are very real. Obviously. I don't want to have to go into how obvious it is that there are many conspiracies on the government, on a geopolitical level, that are very real. I've gone into it before. But there are also high-level conspiracies that are BS. But again, that shows you the herd mentality. You know, there are some people, educated people, who will come out with statements like, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. I got no time for conspiracy theories. That right there is mind-blowingly ignorant to come out with something like that. I don't believe in conspiracy theories. All a conspiracy is, the dictionary definition, is when two or more people conspire to do something illegal or harmful. That's it. That's all a conspiracy is. So the idea that that doesn't take place on a geopolitical level, on a corporate level, how rational is it to think that people don't conspire on a corporate level when we know for a fact that people get convicted on conspiracy charges in courts up and down the land every single week? So people are always conspiring. There's always we're drowning in conspiracies. Human beings can't stop conspiring. But yet we're led to believe it's only us, the great unwashed. We're the ones who conspire with each other to sell drugs or commit murder or commit fraud. But the upper echelons, the elite, they don't conspire to do anything. whenever they are conspiring, we're to dismiss it with the wave of a hand. When they're accused of conspiracy theory, nonsense. That is irrational beyond belief. But of course, the mainstream media have their own conspiracy theories, which these kind of idiots, many of them educated people, will wholeheartedly believe in because the mainstream media are pushing it. Maybe it's a conspiracy about the Russians doing something, or maybe it's a conspiracy about weapons of mass destruction, or maybe it's a conspiracy about Assad. There's always some kind of conspiracy that the mainstream media are pushing. Where's the evidence? Oh, well, we can't, it's classified, and you know, it would endanger national security if we showed you the evidence. So basically, take our word for it. That's your evidence. We say this is going on, take our word for it. Unbelievable. And people, educated people, will believe that. They won't even call it a conspiracy theory. But yeah, when someone questions the very government who are coming out with these conspiracy theories, oh yeah, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. I don't entertain them, got no time for them. That right there is the herd mentality. That right there is the hive mind. That right there is what Edward Bernays was talking about. That right there is why it's so easy for the social engineers to control society. Because of that kind of mentality. Anyway, I'll leave it there, people. Hopefully you've enjoyed this podcast and got something from it. I'll catch you on the next one. It's happening, I'm out.